This is an interview with Mr. Chester Media for the Youngstown State University Oral History Project by David Arms, Youngstown, Ohio, March 1st, 1976, at approximately 10 a.m. in the morning. We are in his office at 10, is this Eastwood Street?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Youngstown, Ohio.
118 Eastwood Street.
Excuse me, 118 Eastwood Street, Youngstown, Ohio. Mr. Media, could you just give me a little background information on yourself, some of your personal history? Where were you born, brought up, educated?
Well, I was born in Erie Cove, Pennsylvania, January 26, 1922. My family moved into the Youngstown area in 1928. I was reared in the public schools and the parochial school system. I graduated from St. Columbus School, grade school, 1935. I had such famous teachers as Sister Monica, Mother Frances, Sister Helen. I then went to Hayes, had some famous teachers there. Matt Flowers, still living, Mr. Guys White. Then proceeded from there to Rayen and had some of the famous teachers of Rayen School under that I was under, some that I cherish very much. Mr. Barnhill just died. He was my shop teacher. I had another fine friend in Miss Hamilton, Mr. Tier, Mr. Herr. And I left Rayen in 1938, went to Toledo, Ohio to finish my education in high school my last year. Due to the death of an uncle, I had to go up and help another uncle clean up two of his businesses. He had a coal yard. In those days, he used to sell coal, believe it or not, and a service station. I ran the service station and went to school nights. I graduated from Toledo Night School in 1939. Came back to Youngstown in 1941, worked at the William B. Pollock Company as a craneman for a while. Then I volunteered for the Army of the United States. Went in as a private in 1942. Proceeded to Camp Robinson, Arkansas, was in basic training. Well, first I went to Fort Hayes. Everybody went to Fort Hayes from Youngstown. Mm-hmm. And within 3 days, though, I was in the real Army down at Camp Robinson, Arkansas, where I spent 6 weeks in what they call BIRTC, Basic Infantry Training Replacement Center. This was where they took a young man and turned him into a complete replacement for an overseas assignment. At the end of 6 weeks, I guess they decided I had some talents, and they decided to send me to non-com school. I went to a non-com school for 2 weeks, and from there they sent me to OCS. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, in 6 months and 7 days from the time I was a private, I became a second lieutenant, graduating from Fort Benning. I wore those cross rifles and had a strong admiration for the Army. I came home, got married in April of 43, proceeded to my first assignment, the 88th Infantry Division at Camp Gruber, Oklahoma. There, I became a platoon leader in the 349th Infantry Regiment, and I was in Company C. I had one of the greatest thrills of my life. I reported into Camp Gruber on a Wednesday, took my platoon, and on a Sunday, we were told we had a very distinguished visitor coming into camp. We would march in full division, review, and lo and behold, it turned out to be none other than Franklin D. Roosevelt, the President of the United States, who was coming into the area to, he was making a tour of all the Southern Army camps. And I had the privilege of having been one of seven new officers that just joined a division to sit down and eat chili on a Sunday afternoon with the President of the United States. down at a mess hall in one of the engineers' groups, and to me this was a very, very fine privilege. I still remember the president sitting there. They drove his car up on a flatbed trailer truck. He had a red Buick. I'll never forget it. And he sat there in that red Buick as we marched by and gave him eyes right. From there, we went into the maneuvers with General Hodges, the Third Army maneuvers. I became an umpire, and I was out in the field in Louisiana one day when a runner came up to me and said, "Are you Lieutenant Amedi?" And I said, "Yes." He says, "I have special orders for you out of Washington." I said, "What?" And I opened them up, and here was orders transferring me to the Army Air Corps. I had applied for the Army Air Corps to go into pilot's training, and lo and behold, they caught up with me. I brought these down to my regimental commander, and within one day, he had me on leave for 7 days on my way to my new assignment. I went into pilot training. I came home for a week and went back. Went through the accelerated program. Mm-hmm. We were at pre-flight for just 2 weeks, where the normal cadet got it for 18 weeks. I was sent right on out into a training unit flying PT-19s at Stanford, Texas. From there to Perrin Field, flying the BT-13, and then to advanced training, where I graduated twin engine in the AT-10. I then went to transition training with the C-47s out in Alliance, Nebraska, George Field, then left from there for my overseas assignment, which was the 1st Air Commando Group in the China-India-Burma Theater. Mm-hmm. I was there approximately 11 months. I flew 153 combat missions and got several fine decorations and awards, the Distinguished Flying Cross twice, your medal. I was in 5 battle campaigns. I flew the hump. That was a part-time job for us. Whenever we were in between combat missions, they'd put us on the hump. Came back to Youngstown.
Did you go over this hump, what was the hump flight?
Oh yes, I had 33 trips over the hump.
I see. And what did this consist of? I mean, what did the hump?
Well, flying the hump was the Himalayas. It was mm-hmm. the range of mountains between Mishinaw and Kunming. Mm-hmm. And it was 3 hours and 45 minutes of very treacherous flying. We had to fly the south route because we were flying C-47s. We couldn't get up over the mountains to the north. We had to face the enemy's challenges flying the south route because the Goony bird that we were flying could only go to 15,500 feet loaded. Mm-hmm. And then that was a strain. But there was one good factor there. The weather was such a horrible situation that the fighters couldn't come up in very... I only flew the hump on 2 occasions where I got to see the Burma Road below me, and that was in part. We got jumped one day. I went into a big thunderstorm. The fighter pilot couldn't come in after me, so I took the thunderstorm rather than take his bullets. But the weather was just... very, very adverse all the time. World's worst. You sit back now and you wonder how you ever did it. Mm-hmm. You didn't have the electronic gear that you have today in an aircraft. The navigational aid you had was a little bird dog. You had the old coffee grinder radio, and that was it. Mm-hmm. You made your instrument letdowns, mostly time and distance, and if everything was right, you got down between the valleys and between the mountain peaks into the valley, and but I enjoyed it. I'll say this much: it made a heck of a good pilot out of you very fast.
Mm-hmm. Then you came back to Youngstown. Is that it after that?
I came back to Girard, Ohio, and then went to Youngstown University. I finished Youngstown University in 2 years, going through days, nights, mm-hmm. weekends, the whole system. In two years, I got my first degree in business administration, a second degree in education. During this time, I was working full-time in a mill and building a house. So I was a little busy boy. I graduated from Youngstown U in 48 and went to work for the city of Youngstown in their housing department for about a year. In 1950, I took this job with the Youngstown Metropolitan Housing Authority as superintendent of maintenance. I have been active with the housing authority since then, and I've gone up through the ranks, having become the deputy director for development, management, maintenance operations, and then director in 1961.
Now, when did you become affiliated with the Air Force Reserve?
Well, it's a strange thing. I came right out of the service, and I was one of the individuals that promoted continuation of the reserves. At that time, there was a Reserve Officers Association, and you paid a $5 a year membership dues. You got a magazine, and that was about it. Mm-hmm. The reserves were not the type of reserves that they had in previous years before the war. They had an awful lot of equipment at the end of World War II, and they...
All right.
Now, this Reserve Officers Association really was very instrumental in getting the reserve units for Air Force and Army and Navy assigned to this particular area here, and I took a very active part in the reserves. To give you an idea how much interest there was at the end of World War II, I'll never forget, I got home in January of 1946, and the first meeting was called in March, and it was up at the Amshi Emeth Temple Auditorium on Elm Street, which is now a vacant temple. Mm-hmm. Over 500 reservists from this area responded to a little newspaper statement, a little newspaper story about the reserves coming into being.
Okay.
And at this particular event, there was a gentleman by the name of Powers, who was a lawyer. He has since died. Ray Powers, very fine gentleman. Robert Weimer, Ed Roberts, John Esch, John was a lawyer, so was Ed Roberts a lawyer, and a Captain Wingate, who unfortunately was not in the latter part of World War II, but he was a reservist that had been the last president of the Reserve Officers Association of Mahoning chapter, and he lived in Struthers, but he was an arrested TB case. He later died also. But from this meeting emanated the future of the reserves, and there was an election held, and lo and behold, I was elected secretary, and I never will forget having to address approximately 500. In that day and age, it was a penny postcard.
Mm-hmm.
We made a stamp, and we just roll the message on the stamp, but everyone had to have it hand addressed. Well, from there, we got the ROA going, and as a result of the ROA, we were able to get some reserve units started. And 28 of us responded one day when an AT-6 landed out of Youngstown Muni Airport. Youngstown Muni Airport at that time had the runway 189, was the main runway. And today that's just a little taxi area.
Mm-hmm.
They had a very small building out there. They had the big hangar and the little unit, which is now presently the baggage section. That's how big it was. It consisted of four rooms. We were able to talk the city of Youngstown into one of these rooms, and that became actually the liaison office for our flying reserve unit, which was really at Cleveland Hopkins Airport. We were a part of the 443rd Troop Carrier Squadron. They would send down AT-6s with instructor pilots, pick us up, fly us up to Cleveland, and we would do transition work out of the Cleveland Hopkins Airport. And this would be on a Saturday, and then again on a Sunday. We had no quarters, no place to stay, no pay. Everything was just done from the standpoint of patriotism. Now, the Air Force Reserve Unit continued this way, and then in 1948, the unit moved to Pittsburgh. There we had AT-6s and an AT-11. We had four AT-6s assigned to us here at Youngstown, and we actually kept them on the grass with tie downs. We had one sergeant who was a crew chief type, line chief. He maintained them up here. When the airplane got down to where it needed something done, we'd fly it down to Pittsburgh. Greater Pittsburgh Airport at that time was strictly an Army airport. There was nobody flying out of that but the Army. And we were known as the 58th Troop Carrier Squadron locally. We had an accident-free record until one day there was a fellow that worked in the tower, went out and took one of our airplanes, went out to buzz a train up near Nutwood, and he crashed. And it was unfortunate. It was an unauthorized type of flight in part. We never did get all the details to it, but it was strictly a pilot error type thing. There are pictures in the rotogravure section in 1958 that show Youngstown area pilots take to the air, and it shows a beautiful formation of AT-6s, and I'm sitting in the third one. We had one of our good pilots named Walter Pittman from the Erie area. He later went into Korea, and he got killed in a P-51 shot down there. Well, our unit then was dissolved here with the coming of the C-46 unit at Pittsburgh. And those of us that remained went to Pittsburgh, and we would commute. We'd drive down, and again, no pay, strictly for flying. And the Air Force, as you know, became its own independent branch in 1948. It became a service of itself, and we went into blue. I never will forget, in January of 1949, or was it 1950, when I got a call one day asking if I could ferry a C-46 out to Burbank, California, and take a AT-11 back to Pittsburgh. So I talked one of my friends from Youngstown who was in the reserves with me, Bob Pavone. At the time I was in between classes, and we drove down to Pittsburgh. We took this 46 off, and we got out to California 2.5 days later. We had headwinds of over 120 knots, and we were actually, our ground speed was 90 miles per hour. That time we were measuring everything in miles per hour rather than knots. We got out to California, and at that time there was a ruling, a regulation. You could not fly nights, nor could you fly instruments if you were ferrying an airplane. And the doggone weather at the San Bernardino Pass got so bad, we were stuck for 10 days. And Bob Pavone and I ended up sleeping in the Burbank terminal in our flying suits. The first night we stayed at the Hollywood Plaza Hotel, but after that we were going to come back, but we were running out of money, and I think we hit Youngstown with about 17 cents when we made made our trip back, but we had all kinds of delays and problems en route mechanical. The 46 took us out all right, but the AT-11, which was being rebuilt out at Burbank, was in bad shape. Strange how things will happen. Now, I'm sitting here telling you about this, but one thing I do remember is talking to the last guy that talked to Richard Bong, the famous ace. Bong got killed, taken off from Burbank Airport. And what happened is he had a jet, a shooting star, and it lost a fuel pump on takeoff. And as a result of his accident, the Air Force put a set of booster pumps on, an auxiliary pump that would cut in the event of failure of another. But this fellow was telling us that he was the last man to talk to Richard Bong when he crashed. But we got back to Youngstown. Well, anyway, to make the story a little shorter, I took on this new job with the Housing Authority, and it required my weekends to be on duty because of the being superintendent of maintenance. I had a big responsibility. So I had to pull out of the unit in Pittsburgh, and lo and behold, I pulled out of the unit, and 2 months later, Korea broke, and they were recalled active duty. Well, in the meantime, I got an assignment out of Cleveland with the what was known as the VARTU program, V-A-R-T-U, Volunteer Air Force Reserve Training Unit. We were able to get a unit established here in Youngstown where we would merely train on paper. We had lectures, guest lectures, and we had a Sergeant Fiegel, mm-hmm. who was actually our commander, but later on we got a Lieutenant Colonel by the name of Hamilton, who was with the General Electric Lamp Company and is now in the Philippines mm-hmm. with that same company. He became our commander. He left, and then I was made the commander. I was a captain. Well, the VARTU units finally, they stayed solvent, but this was not my particular bailiwick. I wanted to get into something more connected with actual flying. There was a unit in Cleveland that met once a month, and it was located at 1500 Euclid Avenue. And here they actually had a good course in operations. I decided this was going to be my career area. So I proceeded to talk Harry Harris and Jack Lewis, two of Youngstown's reserve captains, and we would drive up to Cleveland at 4 o'clock on a Saturday morning, have breakfast and be in place for our training session that would start at 8, and it would break up at 5 o'clock that afternoon. We got no pay. We merely got points. Mm-hmm. Personally, I became the training officer in the unit, and I learned an awful lot from that position. This was where we first started getting into the Omni mm-hmm. system for navigation, and we got into a little bit of LORAN and SHORAN. Of course, I had been exposed to radar in World War II. But we had a very, very fine commander by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Fay, who was a financial analyst for one of the rubber companies, and he lived in Hudson, Ohio. Well, following that, I would take a two-week tour each year, and they would send us normally up to Mitchell Field Air Force Base, and here we got in actual flying, and I was always assigned to operations. Then I became interested in trying to get a reserve unit here. We heard by way of the grapevine that the Korean War was over with, and they were planning on a fly-in unit to be somewhere to service the Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Akron, Youngstown area because of the population. Having made friends with General Roger W. Brown, who was the commander at Mitchell Field for the 1st Air Force. I became his liaison officer because there was an awful lot of political problems that developed here with the Youngstown Muni Airport. It seems like the private operator, Mr. Beckett, and there was opposition from George Reese, the aviation writer, that they wanted no part of the military coming in to Youngstown. There was a unit here now. Remember the 86th Interceptor Squadron and group was located at the base flying first F-80s, then 84s, and then later 102s. Mm-hmm. And the Air Force had spent considerable monies on lengthening the runway, putting up what all of the present buildings are out there, with the exception of the big hangar, main hangar, 412. The opposition all stemmed one morning when the airport manager walked out and saw an orange water tank. That's the present water tank there. It had been gray and he hadn't noticed it, and suddenly somebody was getting it painted orange and he suddenly noticed this obstacle to aviation. So working with private flyer groups and the airlines, they tried to declare that the water tower was an obstacle to the good landing features that Youngstown provided. And since the regular Air Force was going to disband out here, they should close it down. Of course, there were quite a few patriots here, John Esch, Steve Ritz, Arsene Melnick, Bob Weimer, the late attorney Robert Weimer, myself, Joe Ress, Colonel Ress now, retired. We didn't stand for this. We took an airplane. I got us a reserve airplane and 119, and we flew on down to Washington and went right into the Pentagon. Of course, all this previous time to this, I had kept in touch with General Brown. I was his liaison officer, and he in turn had General Johnson, who was the Continental Air Command commander then. They had CONAC, who was a tenant on the field at Mitchell Field. And the decision finally came down that that hangar was going to be built here. However, we had a very powerful man in Congress, Michael Kerwin, who had certain political connections with some of the local people, and the pressures were put on him by some of the local people at the airport not to permit the reserve unit to come in. Well, we went on into Washington, and we had an interview with a three-star general. And lo and behold, as I walked in there, it was my old commander from the China-India-Burma Theater. And he heard us out. 2 weeks later, the decision was made. We came back to Youngstown. An Under Secretary of the Air Force came into Youngstown. He met with me, with Major Weimer and the special committee from ROA. We advised of him that he should go up and talk with Mr. William Mogg, the editor of the Vindicator. He went up, and this man was a real diplomat. It was a hot day in July. He took his jacket off, threw it over his shoulder, rolled his sleeves up, went up, met with Mr. Mogg, and a week later, the announcement was made the reserve unit would be here. That was the formulation of the 26th Fighter Bomber Squadron, which was going to become affiliated here with F-86Hs. And to that unit, that was the unit that Colonel Hendricks was selected to be the commander of, because he was an ace, had a lot of fighter time. In fact, I had a difficult time getting into the unit, with the exception that General Brown sent a message down to Mark Treat, Major Mark Treat, who was the regular Air Force man assigned to be the what they call the AFTRAC, Air Force Training Unit. The AFTRAC commander was Mark Treat. The reserve commander was Randall Hendricks. Mark Treat got a letter down from Roger W. Brown that I had many qualifications in not only flying, but in other areas, and he desired that I be assigned. Mm-hmm. So with this, I was almost forced upon these fighter pilots. It later
later turned out to be that we didn't have the fighters very long. We got checked out in the T-33. We got a F-86H sent in to us, and we all looked at it and with awe and dismay because we couldn't fly it right then, but we were all looking forward to the opportunity of getting all these F-86Hs. We went up to summer camp, Colonel Hendricks and myself, L. Fowl, Lieutenant L. Fowl, Jerry Parker, and some ground troop, but there was four of us. We each flew T-birds up. We took two T-birds up, Randy and I and Fowl and Parker. And when we landed at Grenier Air Force Base, which was we were going to get checked out in the F-86H, we were met by Major Mark Treat on the ramp. He said, "Gentlemen," he says, "I have bad news for you." He says, "The mission of the Air Force Reserve is now going to be troop carrier. The mission of the National Guard is going to be fighters. We are going to C-119s. I didn't know too much about a C-119, except that it wasn't having too good of a record in the Army, rather the Air Force. But we stuck with the unit, and from there I think probably Colonel Hendricks brought you up to date on the unit out here.
Well, he mentioned some facts, but if you go ahead.
Yeah, well, I can basically tell you this. We operated out of the lower hangar, which was the main hangar 412. We had an aft track organization that supported us maintenance-wise and also supported us in training. We proceeded to transition. Many of our fighter pilots left us because they felt that there wasn't enough challenge to fly the 119. However, those of us that stayed realized there was more of a challenge. It was a very, very good airplane, but it was an unforgiving airplane. It was a systems airplane. You had two electrical systems. You had a high-pressure, low-pressure hydraulic system. You had the AC and DC electrical system. You had three inverters. You had a very complicated fuel system. We found out as we went along with the 119 that it was a tremendous airplane. Of course, we took it in the reserves with an attitude that this is it, we've got to live with it. We made many recommendations. There were many modifications to the airplane. They came out with a monitor bus system, an electrical system, which had been a problem, where we had the great big single tire nose wheel. They came in and modified those with the dual little nose wheel, which took a lot of the shimmying out of it. They came in with a new dorsal fin system in the back on the rear vertical stabilizer, which gave it more stability in the air. It was a real good weather airplane. And I consider myself fortunate to having had the opportunity to fly a couple thousand hours in the reserves in that airplane. We were not an organization as a flying club as we were almost when we first came out of the service. We got down to hard work. We had swordfish missions, which would take us anywhere from 17 to 21 hours when they were trying to develop the radar systems in defense. We would take a crew of three people, a pilot, a co-pilot, a navigator, and a crew chief, four people. Our missions would take us either from here to Dover, Delaware, or from here to Andrews, and sometimes to Mitchell Field. We would fly 100 miles out over the ocean and then fly a racetrack pattern for maybe seven straight hours while they were calibrating radar equipment, and this was at high altitude on oxygen. We feel that many of us played a part in helping develop these radar units, which were coming out of Lincoln Laboratories and other areas in the East Coast. Our other missions, we would go out on cargo hauling missions for maybe 4 to 5, 6 days. When you left home, you never knew where you were going to end up. We had an awful lot of overwater flights to Panama, to Harmon up in Newfoundland, to Bermuda. Some of the Bermuda flights were very enchanting and very memorable. We had many squares we had to fill with regards to training requirements. For instance, you had to shoot so many approaches each 6 months, both day and night. You had so much weather time you had to get. You had so many formation missions, so many drops of personnel. You also had so many drops of heavy equipment drops, and these usually brought us down to Fort Bragg. It would be not unusual for a crew or three crews to fly down to Lawson Field and support paratroopers on the regular Army airborne. I can remember flying down there one Friday night and having dropped 842 paratroopers on one weekend, which was just Saturday and Sunday morning. We would do this at Fort Bragg also. We would also do this at Camp Camel, Fort Camel. The support that we gave the airborne was tremendous. There was always 7 airplanes around the clock, 7 days a week, from different units around the United States, from the Air Force Reserve, supporting the airborne missions on training. Of course, San Cedro broke, we were there. We hauled barbed wire and other equipment. We were involved in Alabama when the federal government invoked the made the big decision that they were going to keep that university open. We hauled barbed wire there. I was involved in that. Whenever there was a flood somewhere and it was necessary to haul supplies, we were called out. When Cuba broke, our unit was not called. We were flying then the C model of the 119. And due to the parts problems and inventory, every unit with G models was called on active duty. We were C1, which was the top rating for combat readiness. Many of the units recalled were C3, and to this day I still say, and Randy supports me on this, that the reason for this was we were C1, we didn't need the training, they could pull us out anytime. The C3 units had to be shaped up. We had some of the best mechanics and technicians. Of course, I think maybe Colonel Hendricks told you that in the early 60s they went from the aft-track concept to the air technician concept, where they actually took reservists, hired them, and they were full-time. Well, I wasn't. I was always called a pure reservist. We had alert systems that were developed which required certain people to be in an airplane ready to take off within 1 hour's notice, and I was one of these, having been close here many times on an ORI and sometimes on actual alert calls where they were testing us. From the time I got the call to the time I reported to the airplane, filed my clearance, did my walk around, and was sitting at the end of the runway in less than 1 hour. And our mission at that time required at least 3 aircraft to be in this configuration. We had a very, very fine safety flying record. We achieved the 25,000 hour mark. We had a big celebration on that. The United Veterans Council saw fit to honor our organization with a huge banquet, which there are many pictures that bring back to us many fine memories. It was unfortunate that in 1968, in December, we lost our only, first and only aircraft that was in our reserve unit when that airplane hit that mountain down in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
Flying hours, flying missions, we had many emergencies. We were always able to combat with them. It brings back many memories as I sit here now. But I can honestly say it was a tremendous experience for me, and I wouldn't take $1 million for all of it.
How'd your family feel about it?
Well, I had a very fine, understanding wife. My wife and my children, I think, are better because of it.
Uh-huh.
It took an awful lot of time on my part. I can honestly say that every Wednesday night I flew, every Saturday and every Sunday, 3 weekends a month, I was in a C-119 or at the airbase.
Mm-hmm.
I had 1 weekend per month that I kept up with my family. It was kind of hard on my dog. He didn't understand it. And it was kind of hard on my grass because I'd have to, many times at night, turn my car lights on and let the car idle and run while I would cut grass at 11, 12 o'clock at night during the week, so I could have the weekend free. I'll say this, we visited practically, well, every state in the Union, including Alaska. We didn't get to Hawaii, but I met many fine people. We had many fine experiences, and I truly cherish my reserve assignments and my reserve affiliation.
You do it again in a minute, is that it?
Oh, I'd jump at it. The only reason that I got out was I was up with my 5 years and my star didn't come through. I had it in the grasp of my hand, but lost it on account of a bleeding ulcer that I developed later.
Uh-huh.
But through it, I met such great men as General Feloy. I had the privilege of meeting President Roosevelt in the Army, later on Eisenhower. I saw Nixon. I stood in the honor guard for President Hoover and MacArthur. They didn't use our unit here, but our home wing, our wing down at Andrews Air Force was in Kennedy's honor guard. I was privileged with that one plaque there that I cherish very much.
Mm-hmm.
I was chosen as the outstanding airman for pilot
from three different wings. That was the days, the old 459 troop carrier wing. I received a service award, and this was in competition with Pittsburgh, Washington, and Youngstown.
So I had some fine days.
Oh, thank you. I think it's been a real good
Say this much, that the finest people in the world are reservists, and I find this in all branches of the service.
Mm-hmm.
We had a close relationship with the Navy and the Army. We supported the Army when we could, and we supported the Navy when we could. When you launched your boat out here on
you launched your Navy unit, had a boat out at Milton Dam.
Uh-huh.
We did a flyover on that Sunday morning. I know the weather was very bad, but we were able to sneak. We were going to try to get a formation through, but the weather was too bad for formation, but we sent a single ship up. Many of our missions flying in the 119 were low level, brought us out over low level pre-flown tested areas. And occasionally, I get out, like a couple weeks ago, I was making a speech up at Ashtabula, Dave, and in my introduction, I was introduced as a former pilot down here, and later on, one of the fellas says, "Boy, I sure miss those C-119s that used to fly over in formation, low level." He said, "My kids and I used to stand out in that yard, and we realized a little bit
what the strength of America was when we see up there. We don't see anymore. What happened?
Mm-hmm. Did you ever fly any, like, say, Army, Navy reservists down to any of their training?
Oh, yes. We used to get involved in a lot of any support mission. Mm-hmm. In fact, many of your Navy people, many of our Bermuda trips were supporting your Navy personnel. Mm-hmm. In fact, one time we had to fly hazardous cargo. Mm-hmm. This was another thing. We were nuclear qualified. And but many of our airlifts were supporting Army units going someplace. Mm-hmm. I recall one summer camp when Army National Guard developed a paratroop unit, and we picked up paratroopers. I had an airplane pick them up at Cleveland Hopkins at Gate 10. We had one group pick up people at Toledo. Another airplane picked up paratroopers at Springfield. Mm-hmm. Another one at Columbus, and we all met at Huntington, West Virginia. And from there, we got our briefing, and we dropped them down in West Virginia. And I'll never forget, this National Guard colonel mm-hmm. claimed that I'd never even find the drop zone. I happened to be the mission commander on this one. This was about 1967, 66. And I bet him the drop zone was a farmyard, a barnyard. Mm-hmm. And the bend in the river was such that there was a hill here, mm-hmm. and as you came across low level, you couldn't see. You were strictly on a heading, you know, and then you had to pop up and drop. And Nick Parrish was our drop zone officer, and he went out to the drop zone, and we hit this thing. When you fly down in West Virginia for an hour and 5 minutes on a triangular type pattern as we were, the only ground fix that we had was a sawmill mm-hmm. with smoke coming out of it, and the weather wasn't the best that morning, and I almost scratched the mission, but we were determined that we were going to get it done, and finally they gave me the weather that was, it was just, I could have scratched it and nobody would have condemned me. Mm-hmm. So I said it would be a go because I had that much confidence in my men. And we flew that triangular pattern, and when we came to our pop-up point, we popped up and we dropped those troopers out. This colonel, later on I found out, landed right in the pigsty on the back of a big sow, and I won a quart of whiskey from him. And he's the president of a bank down there, in one of those banks in Huntington. And it was became rather a joke throughout the United States about this colonel landing on this pig's back. He claimed we couldn't hit the drop zone. We sure hit it. We pinpointed him right in the center.
Well, that's good. Is there anything I forgot maybe to ask you, Colonel, that you'd like to add anything in here?
Well, I think that the Air Reserve, of which we were a part, we were one of many units, and the Navy Reserve and the Army Reserve, I think, were insurance policies for our government and our people. And I really and truly think that the strength from these reservists, with equipment, know-how, and manpower, was the deterrent mm-hmm. that probably kept us from war on at least two occasions. The Korea and I think Cuba would have been a disaster. I know that Mr. Kennedy would have called us all out real quick. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much.